He began to try frantically to get them off, so as to have the free use of his legs. He wanted to cuss Gus for having suggested sticking the rifle in his pants leg. He could never get it out in time to shoot an Indian, if one appeared, and it was causing him terrible aggravation. He fought to the surface again, and went under. And when he came up, he wanted to yell for help, and then remembered there would be no one around to hear him but Indians. Then his leg was almost jerked off. He had been swept close to the bank, and the dragging gun had caught in some underbrush. The bank was only a few feet away, and he tried to claw over to it, but that didn't work. While he was struggling, the pants came off, and he was swept down the river backwards. One minute he could see the south bank of the river, and the next minute all he could see was water. Twice he opened his mouth to suck in air and sucked in water instead, some of which came back out his nose. His legs and feet were so numb from the cold water that he couldn't feel them. He never remembered getting out of the water, but somehow he did, for when he next took note of things, he was laying in the mud, his feet still in the water. He was stark naked and the mud was cold, so he pulled himself up and laboriously climbed the bank. It was only 8 or 10 feet high, but it was slippery. When he got up, he wanted to lay in the grass and go to sleep, but he was awake enough to think about his situation, and thinking soon made him wakeful. He hadn't drowned, but he was naked, unarmed, without food, and something like 100 miles from the Hat Creek wagon. He didn't know the country and was up against some tough Indians who did. Gus was sick and maybe dying somewhere upriver. It would be daylight in a few hours, and the danger from Indians would increase. P.I. at once started walking as fast as he could. Though it had stopped raining, it was still cloudy, and he could not see one star or the moon, or for that matter, anything either on heaven or earth. The awful thought struck him that, rolling around and around in the water, he might have confused north and south and crawled up the wrong bank. He might be walking north, in which case he was as good as dead. But he couldn't stop to worry about it. He had to move. He had lost his pack and his gun in the river, and as soon as the river sank to being a normal stream again, they would all be lying in the creek bed in plain sight. If the Indians found them, they would know he was gone, and that Gus was alone, which would make things hot for Gus. If they were in a tracking mood, it would also make things hot for him. They had horses, and could run him down in a matter of hours. The faster he traveled, the better chance he had. After he had thought about it for a while, P was profoundly glad the night was so dark. He wished it could stay dark forever, at least until he pulled in sight of the herd. When he thought of all the perils he was exposed to, it was all he could do to keep from running. He remembered vividly all the things Indians did to white men. In his rangering days, he had helped bury several men who had had such things done to them, and memories of those charred and gouged corpses was with him in the darkness. With him, too, and just as terrifying, was the memory of the great orange bear who had nearly ripped the Texas bull wide open. He remembered how fast the bear had gone when they tried to chase it on horseback. If such a bear spotted him, he felt he would probably just lie down and give up. The darkness didn't last. The only blessing the light brought was that P.I. caught a glimpse of the North Star as the clouds were breaking. He knew at least that he was going in the right direction. The sun soon came up, and he remembered Gus's warning not to travel in the daytime. P.I. decided to ignore it. For one thing, he was on an absolutely open plain, where there was no good place to hide. He might as well be moving as sitting. When he looked ahead, he felt very discouraged, for the country seemed endless. It seemed to him he could see almost 100 miles, just empty country, and he had to walk it. He had never been an advocate of walking, and coming up the trail horseback had given him even less affection for it. He had never bargained for doing so much walking, especially barefoot. Before he had gone more than a mile, his feet were cut and sore. The plains looked grassy and smooth, but there were rocks scattered here and there, and he stepped on a good number of them. Also, it embarrassed him that he was naked. Of course, there was no one around to see him, but he could see himself, and it was disconcerting. The captain would be mighty surprised to see him come tramping up naked, The boys would undoubtedly think it hilarious and would kid him about it for weeks. At first, the nakedness worried him almost as much as his sore feet, but before he had walked half a day, his feet hurt so much that he had stopped caring whether he was naked or even alive. He had to wade two little creeks, and he got into some thorny underbrush in one of them. Soon, every step was painful, but he knew he had to keep walking or he would never find the boys. Every time he looked back, he expected to see either Indians or a bear. By evening, he was just stumbling along. He found a good patch of high grass and weeds and lay down to sleep for a while. He woke up, bitterly cold, to find it was snowing. A squall had blown in. P.I. heard a strange sound and took a minute to realize it was his own chattering teeth. His feet were so sore he could scarcely walk on them, and the snow didn't help. It was a wet snow, melting almost as it fell, but that didn't make it much more comfortable. Somehow he hobbled south all night. The snow soon stopped, but his feet were very cold, and every time he stepped on a rock in the dark, they hurt so he could hardly keep from crying out. He felt very weak and empty and knew he wasn't making very good time. He bitterly regretted not having hung on to some of the jerky, or his rifle, or something. Gus would think him a fine fool if he found out he had lost everything before he even got clear of the creek. In his weariness, he even forgot for a time that Gus had been left in the little cave. Several times he spoke to Gus as he stumbled along, mainly asking directions. For a time he felt Gus was just ahead, leading the way. Or was it Dietz? P.I. felt confused. Whoever it was wouldn't speak to him, and yet he continued to ask questions. He took comfort in thinking Gus or Dietz was there. They were the best scouts. They would lead him in. When the second day dawned, P.I. stopped to rest. He realized no one was with him, unless it was ghosts. But then it might be ghosts. Gus might be dead by then, and Dietz was for sure. Maybe one of them, having nothing to do, had decided to float along ahead of him, guiding him to the Yellowstone. When he looked at his feet, it seemed to him that he might make almost as good time crawling or walking on his hands. His feet were swollen to twice their size, besides being cut here and there. Yet they were the only feet he had, and after dozing for an hour in the sun, he got up and hobbled on. He was very hungry and wished he had paid more attention to Pocampo, who could find things to eat just by walking along looking. P tried to look, but he saw nothing but grass and weeds. Fortunately, he struck several small creeks and had plenty of water. Once, he even managed to sluice some minnows up on dry land. They wiggled and flopped and were hard to catch, and of course, they only made a few bites, but they were better than nothing. His biggest piece of luck came late that day when he was able to knock over a big prairie chicken with a rock. He only broke the bird's wing and had to chase it through the grass a long way, but the bird tired before he did, and he finally caught it, skinned it, and ate it raw. He rested 3 hours and then hobbled on through another night. The third morning he could barely make himself move. His feet were worse than ever, the plains ahead still endless and empty. His eyes ached from looking so hard for the line of the Yellowstone, but he still couldn't see it. It was the emptiness that discouraged him most. He had almost stopped worrying about Indians and bears. What he had worried about was being lost. He knew by the stars that he was still going south, but south where? Maybe he had veered east of the herd, or west of it, so that no one would spot him. Maybe he had already passed them, in which case there was little hope. The snows would just come and freeze him, or else he would starve. He lay until mid-morning, unable to decide what to do. For a time, he thought the best plan might be just to sit. There were supposed to be soldiers in Montana somewhere. If he sat long enough, maybe some would find him. Finally, though, he got up and stumbled on. The soldiers would only find his bones, if they found anything. It was a blazing day, so hot it made him feel annoyed at Montana weather. What kind of country was it where you could get frostbit one night and sunburn 2 days later? He saw a couple of prairie dogs and wasted an hour trying to get one with a rock. But the prairie dogs were smarter than prairie chickens, and he never came close. He stumbled on, feeling the sun would burn off what skin he had left. Several times during the afternoon he fell. He grew light-headed and felt as if he were floating. Then his swollen feet would refuse to work, and instead of floating, he would fall. Once he came to, lying flat on his back in the grass, the sun burning into his eyes. He scrambled up and looked around, feeling the herd might have walked right past him when he slept. He tried very hard to walk a straight line south, but his legs were so weak that he kept wobbling off course. "Darn you! Walk straight!" he said. The sound of his own cracked voice startled him out of his fury. Then he felt embarrassment. A man who would cuss his own legs just because they were weak was peculiar, he knew. He got the floating feeling again, so strong that he felt frightened. He felt he might be going to float right out of his own body. He wondered if he was dying, if that was how it felt. He had never heard of anyone dying while they were just walking along, but then dying was something he knew little about. He would take a few steps and then feel himself begin to rise out of his own body, which frightened him so that he stumbled and fell. He didn't want to stand up again, and he began to crawl, looking up now and then to see if the herd was in sight. He felt he couldn't live another night so alone and hungry. He would die in the grass like some beaten animal. Then it grew dark, and he wanted to cry with disappointment. He had walked long enough. Surely it was time the boy showed up. Once it was full dark, he stopped and listened. He felt the herd might be close, and if he listened, maybe he would hear the Irishman singing. He heard no singing, but when he got up and tried to stumble on, he felt the presence of his guide again. This time, he knew it was Dietz. He couldn't see him because it was dark, and of course, Dietz was dark. But he lost the floating feeling and walked easier, though he was a little scared. He didn't know what the rules were with people who were dead. He would have liked to say something, but felt he shouldn't. Dietz might go away and leave him to stumble along in the dark if he said anything. Maybe travel was no trouble for the dead. He didn't know. It was considerable trouble for him. He walked slow, for he didn't like to fall. But he walked on all night. 2 hours after sunup the next day, Dish Boget, who had been sent off to do a little scouting, thought he saw a figure far to the north. At first, he couldn't tell if it was a man or an antelope. If it was a man, it was an Indian, he imagined, and he raced back to the herd and got the captain, who had been shoeing the mare. Always an arduous task. She hated anyone to handle her feet and had to be securely snubbed before she would submit to it. Fortunately, call was finished, and he rode back with Dish to look for the man. There was no sign of him at first, but Dish had a good eye for country and knew where he had seen him. Call privately supposed it had only been an antelope, but he wanted to check. They had crossed the Yellowstone the day before. The men and all the stock had got across safely. Jasper Fant was in his best mood of the trip, having survived all the rivers after all. "There he is," Dish said suddenly. "If it ain't P." Dish was almost stunned with surprise. P was no longer walking. He was sitting down in the grass, naked, nodding his head as if in conversation with somebody. When he heard them, he looked around, as if not particularly surprised, but when they dismounted, there were tears in his eyes. "Howdy, Captain," P.I. said, embarrassed by his own emotion. "You just missed Dietz, I guess." Call saw that P.I. was wounded and out of his head. There was blood on his chest from a shoulder wound. The sun had blotched his body, and his feet were swollen the size of a cow's bladder and cut to shreds. "Is Gus dead?" Call asked, afraid to hear the answer. Though he knew Gus's penchant for trouble, it was a shock to see P.I. in such a state. P.I. had been thinking of Dietz, who had kindly walked him through the night. He was embarrassed to be naked, and he found it hard to turn his mind back to where he could deal with a question the captain had asked him. "The creek's up," It's why I lost my clothes, he said. Call untied his slicker from the saddle and covered P.I. with it. P.I. immediately felt better. He tried to button the slicker so his dingus wouldn't show, but his fingers shook, and Dish Bogat finally did it for him. Is Gus dead? Call asked again. P.I. let his mind turn slowly. Then he remembered that Gus had been sitting with two guns in his hands, not saying a word when he had waded into the river. He had had that bad wound in his leg. The creek was up when I left him, P.I. said. I had to swim down past the Indians, and I lost all my gear. Gus kept my pistol. Where was this? Call asked. Up north, Captain, P.I. said. We dug a cave in a river bank. That's all I know. But he wasn't dead when you left him. No. He sent me off. He said he wanted you to lope on up there and help him with those Indians. Dish Bogat could not adjust to the fact that P.I. was naked and all scarred up. They had had such a peaceful time of it that he had lost the sense that they were in dangerous country. What was that about Dietz? He asked. Help me, P said simply. Are we going after Gus, Captain? We had a hard time getting one of them arrows out, and his leg was giving him pain. You're going to the wagon, Call said. You need some grub. How many Indians were there? P tried to think. A bunch jumped us, he said. About 20, I guess. Gus shot a few. Call and Dish had to lift him. All strength seemed to have left him. Now that he knew he was safe, Dish had to hold him on his horse as they rode back, for P.I. had so little strength that he could not grip the saddle horn. The crew, which had been in high spirits and drunk on their own celebrity, for weren't they the first men to bring a Texas herd across the Yellowstone, sobered up immediately when they saw the condition P.I. was in. Why, hello, boys, P. said, when he was helped off the horse. They all gathered around to greet him, and Bert and Needle Nelson helped him down. Pocampo had some coffee ready. P. reached out for a cup once they had propped him against the wagon, but his hands were too shaky to hold it. Poe fed him a little with a spoon, and between one sip and the next, P. slid from his position and passed out. He collapsed so quickly that no one even caught him. Is he dead? Newt asked, anxious. No, he's just tuckered out, Call said. He was filling his saddlebags with ammunition, glad that he had got new shoes on the mare. He said Dietz helped him, Dish Bogat said. The way P. said it had unnerved him. Dietz was dead and buried back on the Powder River. Call didn't answer. He was pondering the question of whether to take a man with him. I guess he was out of his head, Dish said. I guess that explains it. Pocampo smiled. The dead can help us if we let them. And if they want to, he said. Jasper Fant, delighted not to be among the dead, looked at Poe severely. "Ain't none ever helped me except my own paw," he said. "How'd he help you?" Needle asked. "Left me $20 in his will. I bought this saddle with it, and I've been a cowboy ever since." "You call yourself one, you mean," Soupy Jones said. He had poor relations with Jasper as a result of a dispute over cards. I'm here, ain't I? Jasper said. Just because you lost that hand don't mean I can't cow. Oh, shut your trap, Jasper, Dish said. He had had enough of Jasper and Soupy and felt the whole question of P and Dietz had been treated too brusquely. After all, the first words P had said was that they had just missed Dietz. Dish didn't want to admit it, but he had been scared of ghosts all his life, and he didn't like to think that any were wandering around. It would just make night herding more nerve-wracking, even if the ghost in question was one that might be friendly to him. Then someone noticed that Captain Call was leaving. He took an extra rifle from the wagon and got the slicker that he had lent P, covering P with a blanket. "Just move the stock on north," he said. "Be alert. I'm going to get Gus." The thought of him leaving sent a ripple of apprehension through the camp. Though independent to a man in some respects, the outfit was happier in all respects when Captain Call was around. Or if not the captain, then Gus. Only a few hours earlier, they had felt cocky enough to take on an army. After all, they were the conquerors of the Yellowstone. But now, watching the captain catch a horse for Gus to ride back on, they all felt daunted. The vast plain was beautiful, but it had reduced P.I. to a scarred wreck, and the Indians had Gus holed up somewhere. They might kill him, and the captain, too. All men were mortal, and they felt particularly so. 1,000 Indians might come by nightfall. The Indians might fall on them as they had fallen on Custer. Call had no time to soothe the men with elaborate instructions. If Gus was badly wounded, he would weaken rapidly, and every hour counted. Arriving 10 minutes too late would be as bad as 10 days, or a year for that matter. Besides, the almost beseeching way the men looked at him was irritating. Sometimes they acted as if they would forget how to breathe if he or Gus wasn't there to show them. They were all resourceful men. He knew that if they didn't. And yet at certain times they became like children, wanting to be led. All his adult life he had consented to lead, and yet occasionally, when the men seemed particularly dumbstruck, he wondered why he had done it. He and Augustus had discussed the question of leadership many times. "It ain't complicated," Augustus maintained. "Most men doubt their own abilities. You don't. It's no wonder they want to keep you around. It keeps them from having to worry about failure all the time." "They ain't failures, most of them," Call pointed out. "They can do perfectly well for themselves." Augustus chuckled. "You work too hard," he said. "It puts most men to shame. They figure out they can't keep up, and it's just a step or two from that to feeling that they can't do nothing much unless you're around to get them started." "It don't take on me, which is lucky," he added. "I don't care how hard you work or where you go." "I'd like to see something that could put you to shame," Call said. "My pecker's done it a few times," Augustus said. Call wondered what he meant by that, but didn't ask. When he was packed, he mounted at once and rode over to Dish Boguette. "You're in charge," he said. "Trail on north. I'll be back when I can." Dish paled at the thought of so much responsibility. He had enough worries as it was. What with P.I. talking of ghosts? The captain looked angry, which made the men better reconciled to the fact that he was leaving. All of them feared his angers, but once he left, before he and the mare were even out of sight, their mood of relief changed back to one of apprehension. Jasper Fant, so cheerful only an hour before, sank the fastest. "Good Lord," he said. "Here we are in Montana, and there's Indians and bears, and it's winter coming on, and the captain and Gus both off somewhere. I'll be surprised if we don't get massacred." For once, Soupy Jones didn't have a word to say.
Chapter 95.
Augustus kept his pistol cocked all night, once P.I. left. He watched the surface of the river closely. For the trick he hoped might work for P could also work for the Indians. They might put a log in the water and float down on him, using the log for cover. He tried to look and listen closely, a task not helped by the fact that he was shaking and feverish. He expected the Indians to come sliding out of the water like big snakes right in front of him, but none came. And as his fever mounted, he began to mumble. From time to time, he was half aware that he was delirious, but there was nothing he could do about it. Anyway, he preferred the delirium to the tedium of waiting for the Indians to attack. 1 minute he would be trying to watch the black water, the next he would be back at Clara's. At times he saw her face vividly. The dawn broke sunny. Bad as he felt, Augustus still enjoyed seeing the sun. It helped clear his head and stirred him to thoughts of escape. He was sick of the little cold cave under the river bank. He had thought to wait there for Call, but the more he considered, the more he felt to be a bad plan. Call's arrival was days away, and dependent on P getting through. If P didn't get through, and the chances were good that he wouldn't, then Call might not even start to look for him for another week. As a student of wounds, he knew just by looking at his leg that he was in trouble. The leg was yellowish, with black streaks striping the yellow. Blood poisoning was a possibility. He knew that if he didn't get medical attention within the next few days, his chances were slim. Even waiting for nightfall could be folly. If the Indians caught him in the open, his chances would be equally slim, of course. But it took no deliberation to know that if he had to choose, and he did, he would prefer the active to the passive course. As soon as the sun was well up, he eased out of the cave and stood up. The bad leg throbbed. Even to touch his toes to the ground hurt. The waters were rapidly receding. 50 yards to the east, a game trail led up the creek bank. Augustus decided to use the carbine he had taken off the Indian boy as a crutch. He cut the stirrups off the saddle and lashed one over each end of the rifle, then padded one end of his crude crutch with a piece of saddle leather. He stuffed one pistol under his belt, holstered the other, took his rifle and a pocket full of jerky, and hobbled across along the bank to the animal trail. He edged cautiously out of the riverbed, but saw no Indians. The broad plain was empty for miles. The Indians had left. Augustus wasted no time in speculation. He started at once, hobbling southeast towards Miles City. He hoped he had not more than 30 or 40 miles to go before he struck the town. He was not used to the crutch, and he made poor time. When occasionally he forgot and set his bad foot to the ground, the pain was almost enough to make him pass out. He was weak, and he had to stop every hour or so to rest. In the hot sun, sweat poured out of him, though he felt cold and feared a chill. 2 or 3 miles from where he started, he crossed the tracks of a sizable herd of buffalo. They were probably the reason the Indians had left. With winter coming, buffalo were more important to the warriors than 2 white men, though probably they meant to return and finish off the whites once the hunt was over. All day he persevered, dragging himself along. He stopped less frequently, because he found it hard to get started once he stopped. Rest was seductive, made more so by his tendency to improve the situation through imagination. Maybe the herd had moved north faster than he calculated. Maybe Call would show up the next day and save him the painful business of dragging along with his crutch. Yet he hated waiting almost as much as he hated the traveling. His habit had been to go and meet whatever needed to be met, not to wait idly for what might approach. What was approaching now was death, he knew. He had faced it before and overridden its motion with his own. To sit and wait for it gave it too many advantages. He had seen many men die of wounds and had watched the turning of their spirits from active desire to live to indifference. With a bad wound, the moment indifference took over, life began to subside. Few men rose out of it. Most lost all impulse toward activity and ended by offering death at least a half-hearted welcome. Augustus didn't intend to do that, so he struggled on. When he took his rest, he took them standing up, leaning on the crutch. It took less will to get started if one was standing up. He hobbled over the plain through the long afternoon and twilight, finally collapsing sometime in the night. His hand slipped off the crutch, and he felt it falling from him. In stooping to reach for it, he fell face down, unconscious, before he hit the ground. In his dreams, he was with Lorena, in the tent, on the hot Kansas plains. He longed for her to cool him somehow, touch him with her cool hand, but though she smiled, she didn't cool him. The world had become red, as though the sun had swollen and absorbed it. He felt as if he were lying on the surface of the red sun as it looked at sunset when it sank into the plain. When he got his eyes open, the sun was white, not red, and directly above him, he heard a spitting sound such as a human would make, and his hand went to the pistol at his belt, thinking the Indians had come. But when he turned his head, it was a white man he saw, a very old, small white man in patched buckskins. The old man had a tobacco-stained beard and a bowie knife in his hand. A spotted horse grazed nearby. The old man was just squatting there, watching. Augustus kept his hand on his gun, but didn't draw it. He didn't know if he had the strength to draw it.
"Them was blood Indians," the old man said. "It beats all that they didn't get you. You got enough of them."
"Five is all," Augustus said, raising himself to a sitting position. He didn't like to talk, laying down.
"Seven, I heard," the old man said. "I get along with the Bloods and the Blackfeet, too. Bought lots of beaver from them in the beavering days."
"I'm Augustus McCrae."
"Hugh Auld. Down Miles City, they call me Old Hugh, although I doubt I'm 80 yet."
"Was you meaning to stab me with that knife?" Augustus asked. "I'd rather not shoot you unnecessarily."
Old Hugh grinned and spat again.
"I was about to have a go at cutting off that rotten leg of yours," he said. "Before you come to, I was. That leg's ruined. But I might have a hell of a time cutting through the bone without no saw. Besides, you might have woke up and give me trouble."
"'Spect I would have,"
Augustus said, looking at the leg. It was no longer black-striped, just black.
"We got to take it off," old Hugh said. "If that rot gets in the other leg, you'll lose them both."
Augustus knew the old man was right in everything he said. The leg was rotting, but a bowie knife was no instrument for taking it off.
"How far is Miles City?" he asked. "I guess they got a sawbones there."
"Two, last time I went to town," old Hugh said. "Both drunkards."
"You forgot to inform me of the distance."
40 miles and a fraction. I don't believe you could have walked it."
Augustus used the crutch to pull himself up.
"I might fool you," he said.
Though it was just pride talking, he knew quite well he couldn't have walked it. Just getting to his feet left him nauseous.
"Where'd you come from, stranger?"
the old man asked. He rose to his feet, but did not exactly straighten up. His back was bent. To Augustus, he seemed scarcely 5 feet tall.
"I was setting a deadfall in it. Fall on me," old Hugh explained cheerfully. "Some blood warriors found me. They thought it was funny, but my back never did straighten out."
"We all have our misfortunes," Augustus said. "Could I borrow your horse?"
"Take it. Only don't kick him," old Hugh said. "If you kick him, he'll buck. I'll follow along as best I can in case you fall off."
He had led the spotted horse over and helped Augustus mount. Augustus thought he might pass out, but managed not to. He looked at old Hugh.
"You sure you get along with these Indians?" he asked. "I'd be embarrassed if you came to any trouble on my account."
"I won't," old Hugh said. "They're off stuffing themselves with fresh buffalo meat. I was invited to join them, but I think I'll poke along after you, even though I don't know where you come from."
"Little fart of a town called Lonesome Dove," Augustus said. "It's in South Texas on the Rio Grande."
"Darn,"
the old man said, clearly impressed by the information.
"You're a traveling son of a bitch, ain't you?"
"Does this horse have a name?"
Augustus asked.
"I might need to speak to him."
"I've been calling him Custer," old Hugh said. "I done a little scouting for the general once."
Augustus paused a minute, looking down at the old trapper.
"I got one more favor to ask you. Tie me on. I ain't got strength enough to mount again if I should fall off."
The old man was surprised.
"I guess you've learned some tricks with all your traveling," he said.
He fixed a rawhide loop around Augustus's waist and made it tight to the cantle.
"Let's go, Custer,"
Augustus said, giving the horse rein and remembering not to kick him. 5 hours later, as the sun was setting, he nudged the exhausted horse over a slope north of the Yellowstone and saw the little town of Miles City, 4 or 5 miles to the east. When he got to town, it was nearly dark. He stopped in front of what appeared to be a saloon and found he could not dismount. Then he remembered he was tied on. He couldn't untie the knots in the rawhide, but managed to draw his pistol and fire in the air. The first shot seemed to go unnoticed, but when he fired twice more, several men came to the door of the saloon and looked at him.
"Why, that's old Hugh's horse," one man said in a sullen voice, as if he suspected Augustus of horse theft. "Yes, Mr. Ault was kind enough to loan him to me," Augustus said, staring down at the man. "I've a ruined leg, and would appreciate it if someone would locate me a medical man, quick."
The men walked out and came around the horse. When they saw the leg, one whistled.
"What done that?" he asked.
"An arrow,"
Augustus said.
"Who are you, sir?"
the oldest of the men asked, more respectfully.
"Augustus McCrae, captain in the Texas Rangers. One of you gentlemen will need to help me with these knots."
They hurried to help, but before they could get him off the horse, the red water washed over his eyes again. The spotted horse, named Custer, didn't like so many men around him. He tried to bite one of them, then buck twice, throwing Augustus, who had just been untied, into the street. Two of the men tried to catch the horse, but he easily outran them and raced back out of town.
Chapter 96.
Augustus floated in the red water. Sometimes he saw faces, heard voices, saw more faces. He saw Bolivar and Lippy, his two wives, his three sisters. He saw men long dead whom he had rangered with, saw Pedro Flores and P.I. and a red-headed whore he had taken up with for a month in his riverboating days. He sloshed helplessly back and forth, as if something were churning the water. When the redness receded and he opened his eyes again, he heard a piano playing in the distance. He was in bed in a small, hot room. Through the open window, he could see the great Montana prairie. Looking around, he noticed a small fat man dozing in a chair nearby. The man wore a black frock coat sprinkled with dandruff. A bottle of whiskey and an old bowler hat nearly as disreputable as Lippy's sat on a small bureau. The fat man was snoring peacefully. Feeling considerable pain, Augustus looked down and saw that his left leg was gone. The stump had been bandaged, but the bandage was leaking. Blood seeped through it, though it was a thick bandage.
"If you're the Sawbones, wake up and stop this drip," Augustus said.
He felt irritable and sad and wished the whiskey bottle were in reach. The little fat man jerked as if poked with a fork and opened his eyes. His cheeks were red-streaked from excessive drinking, Augustus supposed. He put both hands on his head as if surprised that it was still there.
"And pass that whiskey if you can spare any. I hope you ain't thrown my leg away."
The doctor jerked again as if every statement pricked him.
"You got a mighty healthy voice for a sick man," the doctor said. "In this room, such a voice is a tight fit."
"Well, it's the only voice I got,"
Augustus said. The doctor put his hands to his temple again.
"It strikes my temples like a 10-pound hammer," he said. "Though I'm sorry to complain, the truth is I don't feel well myself."
"You probably drank too much. If you'll hand me that bottle, I'll reduce your temptations."
The doctor did, but not before taking a swig. Augustus took several while the doctor shuffled around and stood looking out the window. Across the street, the piano was still playing.
"That girl plays beautifully," the doctor said. "They say she studied music in Philadelphia when she was younger."
"How old is she now?" Augustus asked. "Maybe I'll send her a bouquet."
The doctor smiled.
"It's plain you're a man of spirit," he said. That's good. I'm afraid you've a few fractuosities yet to endure.
A few what?
Augustus asked.
You better introduce yourself before you start talking Latin.
Dr. Mobley, the man said. Joseph C. Mobley, to be precise. The C stands for Cincinnatus.
More Latin, I guess, Augustus said. Explain that first bunch of Latin you talked.
I mean, we've got to take off that other leg, Dr. Mobley said. I should have done it while you were out, but frankly, getting the left leg off exhausted me.
It's a good thing. If you'd hacked off my right leg, you'd be the one who was out. I need that right leg.
His gun belt was hanging over a chair nearby, and he reached out and took his pistol from the holster. The doctor looked around, reaching out his hand for the whiskey bottle. Augustus gave it to him, and he took a long drink and handed it back. I understand your attachment to your own appendages, he said, opening the bandage. He winced when he looked at the wound, but kept working. I don't want to cut your other leg off bad enough to get shot in the process. However, you'll die if you don't reconsider. That's a plain fact.
Go buy me some more whiskey, Augustus said. There's money in my pants. Is that girl playing the piano a whore?
Yes. Her name is Dora, the doctor said. Consumptive, I'm afraid. She'll never see Philadelphia again. He began to wrap the leg in a clean bandage. Augustus suddenly grew faint.
Give her $20 out of my pants and tell her to keep playing, he said. And shove this bed a little closer to the window. It's stuffy in here.
The doctor managed to shove the bed over near the window, but the effort tired him so that he sat back down in the chair where he had been dozing. Augustus recovered a little. He watched the doctor a moment.
Physician, heal thyself. Ain't that what they say? He remarked.
Dr. Mobley chuckled unhappily. That's what they say, he said. He breathed heavily for a time and then stood up. I'll go get the whiskey. While I'm about it, I'd advise you to take a sober look at your prospects. If you persist in your attachment to your right leg, it'll be the last opportunity you have to take a sober look at anything.
Don't forget to tip that girl, Augustus said. Hurry back with my whiskey and bring a glass.
Dr. Mobley turned at the door. We should operate today, he said. Within the hour, in fact, although we could wait long enough for you to get thoroughly drunk, if that would help. There's men enough around here to hold you down. I think I could have that leg off in 15 minutes.
You ain't getting that leg. I might could get by with one, but I can't without both.
I assure you your alternative is gloomy, Dr. Mobley said. Why close your own case? You've a taste for music, and you seem to have funds. Why not spend the next few years listening to Horace play the piano?
You said the girl was dying. Just go get the whiskey.
Dr. Mobley returned a little later with 2 bottles of whiskey and a glass. A young giant of a man, so tall he had to stoop to get in the room, followed him. This is Jim, Dr. Mobley said nervously. He's offered to sit with you while I go make my rounds. Augustus cocked his pistol and leveled it at the young man.
Get out, Jim, he said. I don't need company.
Jim left immediately, so immediately that he forgot to stoop and bumped his head on the door frame. Dr. Mobley looked even more nervous. He moved the bureau a little nearer the bed and sat both bottles within Augustus's reach. That was rude, he said.
Listen, you can't have this leg. And if you're thinking of overpowering me, you have to calculate on losing about half the town. I can shoot straight when I'm drunk, too.
I only want to save your life,
Dr. Mowgli said, taking a drink from the first bottle before pouring Augustus a glassful.
It's my worry, mainly. You stated your case, but the jury went against you. Jury won. Did you pay the whore?
I did, Dr. Mowgli said. Since you refuse company, you'll have to drink alone. I have to go deliver a child into this unhappy world.
It's a fine world, though rich in hardships at times.
You won't need to worry about hardships much longer if you insist on keeping that leg, Dr. Mowgli said, somewhat pettishly.
I guess you don't care much for stubborn customers, do you?
No, they irk me, Dr. Mowgli said. You might have lived, but now you'll die. Your reasoning escapes me.
Well, I'll pay your bill right now, Augustus said. My reasoning ain't your concern.
Are you a man of property? The doctor asked.
I've funds in a bank in San Antonio, Augustus said. Also, I own half a cattle herd. It ought to be north of the Yellowstone by now.
I've brought pen and ink, the doctor said. If I were you, I'd make your will while you're still sober. Augustus drank all afternoon and did not use the pen or ink. Once, when the music stopped, he looked out the window and saw a skinny, pockmarked girl in a black dress standing in the street looking up at him curiously. He waved, but could not be sure if she saw him. He took another $20 gold piece from his pants pocket and sailed it out the window toward her. It landed in the street, to the puzzlement of the girl. She walked over and picked up the gold piece, looking up.
It's yours, for the music, Augustus said loudly.
The pockmarked girl smiled, picked up the money, and went back into the saloon. In a minute, Augustus heard the piano again. A little later, his fever rose. He felt hungry, though, and banged on the floor with his pistol until a timid-looking little bartender with a walrus mustache as good as Dish Bogat's opened the door.
Is beefsteak to be had in this town? Augustus asked.
No, but I can get you venison, the bartender said. He was as good as his word. Augustus ate and then vomited in a brass spittoon. His leg was as black as the one that had been lost. He went back to the whiskey and from time to time recovered the misty feeling that he had always been so fond of, the feeling that reminded him of Tennessee mornings. He wished for a woman's company and thought of having someone ask the pockmarked girl if she would come and sit a while. But there was no one to ask, and in time he lost the impulse. In the night, sweating heavily, he awoke to a familiar step. W.F. Call stepped into the room and set a lantern on the bureau.
Well, slow but sure, Augustus said, feeling relieved.
Not too darn slow, Call said. We just found P.I. yesterday. He turned back the covers and looked at Augustus's leg. Dr. Mowgli was also in the room. Call stood looking at the black leg a minute. Its meaning was clear enough. I did plead with him, Captain, Dr. Mowgli said. I told him it should come off. I regret now that I didn't take it when we took the other. He should have, Call said bluntly. I would have known to do that, and I ain't a medical man.
Don't berate the man, Woodrow, Augustus said. If I had waked up with no legs, I would have shot the first man I saw, and Dr. Joseph C. Mowgli was the first man I saw.
Leaving you with a gun was another mistake, Call said. But I guess he didn't know you as well as I do. He looked at the leg again and at the doctor. We could still try it now, he said. He's always been strong. He might still live. Augustus immediately cocked the pistol.
You don't boss me, Woodrow. I'm the one man you don't boss. You also don't boss most of the women. But that don't concern us now.
I wouldn't think that you'd shoot me for trying to save your life, Carl said quietly. Augustus looked sweaty and unsteady, but the range was short.
Not to kill, but I promise to disable you if you don't let me be about this leg.
Never took you for suicide, Gus, Carl said. Men have gotten by without legs. Lots of them lost legs in the war. You don't like to do nothing but sit on the porch and drink whiskey anyway. It don't take legs to do that.
No, and I also like to walk around the spring house once in a while. See if my jug's cooled properly. Or I might want to kick a pig if one aggravates me.
Carl saw that it was pointless unless he wanted to risk a fight. Gus had not uncocked the pistol, either. Carl looked at the doctor to see what he thought.
I wouldn't bother him now, the doctor said. It's much too late. I suppose I'm to blame for not outwitting him. He was brought to me unconscious, or I might have figured out what a testy character he is.
Augustus smiled.
Would you bring Captain Carl a glass? And some of that venison, he said. I imagine he's hungry.
Carl wasn't ready to give up, although he felt it was probably hopeless.
You got those two women back in Nebraska, he pointed out. Those women would race to take care of you.
Clara's got one invalid already, and she's bored with him. Laurie'd look after me, but it would be a sorry life for her.
Not as sorry as the one you rescued her from, Carl reminded him.
You don't get the point, Woodrow. I've walked the earth in my pride all these years. If that's lost, then let the rest be lost with it. There's certain things my vanity won't abide.
That's all it is, too, Carl said bitterly. Your goddamn vanity.
He had expected to find Gus wounded, but not to find him dying. The sight affected him so much that he felt weak of a sudden. When the doctor left the room, he sat down in a chair and took off his hat. He looked at Gus for a long time, trying to think of some argument he might use. But Gus was Gus, and he knew no argument would be of any use. None ever had been. He could either fight him and take off the leg if he won, or else he could sit and watch him die. The doctor seemed convinced that he would die now in any case, though doctors could be wrong in such matters. He tried to gird himself for a fight. Gus might miss, or not even shoot, though both were doubtful. But his own weakness held him in the chair. He was trembling and didn't know why.
Woodrow, I wish you'd relax, Augustus said. You can't save me. And it would be a pity if we fought at this stage. I might kill you accidentally. And them boys would sit out on the plains and freeze.
Carl didn't answer. He felt tired and old and sad. He had pressed the mare all day and all night, had easily found the river where the battle took place, recovered P.I.'s rifle and even his boots and shirt, found Gus's saddle, and raced for Miles City. He had risked ruining the hell bitch. He hadn't, though she was tired. And still, he had arrived too late. Gus would die, and all he could do was keep a death watch. The bartender brought a plate of venison, but he had no appetite. He accepted a glass of whiskey, though, and then another. They had no effect.
I hope you won't become a drunkard over this, Augustus said.
I won't, Carl said. You can uncock that pistol. You want to die, go ahead.
Augustus laughed.
You act like you hold it against me, he said.
I do, Carl said. You got a good head if you'd use it. Man with a good head can be useful.
Doing what? Braiding ropes. Not my style, Captain.
Your goddamn style is your downfall, and it's a wonder it didn't come sooner.
Any special funeral?
Yes. I've been thinking of that. I've a big favor to ask you, and one more to do you.
What favor?
The favor I want from you will be my favor to you. I want to be buried in Clara's orchard.
In Nebraska? Call asked, surprised. I didn't see no orchard. Augustus chuckled.
Not in Nebraska. In Texas. By that little grove of live oaks on South Guadalupe. Remember, we stopped by there a minute.
My God, Carl said, thinking his friend must be delirious. You want me to haul you to Texas? We just got to Montana.
I know where you just got, Augustus said. My burial can wait a spell. I got nothing against wintering in Montana. Just pack me in some salt or charcoal or what you will. I'll keep well enough and you can make the trip in the spring. You'll be a rich cattle king by then and might need a restful trip.
Carl looked at his friend closely. Augustus looked sober and reasonably serious. To Texas? He repeated.
Yes, that's my favor to you. It's the kind of job you was made for. But nobody else could do or even try. Now that the country is about settled, I don't know how you'll keep busy, Woodrow. But if you'll do this for me, you'll be all right for another year, I guess.
You're one of a kind, Gus, Carl said, sighing. We'll all miss you.
Even you, Woodrow?
Augustus asked.
Yes.
Me, Carl said. Why not me?
I take it back, Woodrow. I have no doubt you'll miss me. You'll probably die of boredom this winter, and I'll never get to Clara's orchard.
Why do you call it that?
We had picnics there. I took to calling it that, and it pleased Clara. I could please her oftener in those days.
Well, but is that any reason to go so far to be buried? Carl said. She'd allow you a grave in Nebraska, I'm sure.
Yes, but we had our happiness in Texas. It was my best happiness, too. If you're too lazy to take me to Texas, then just throw me out the window and be done with it.
He spoke with vehemence.
She's got her family in Nebraska, Augustus added more quietly. I don't want to lie there with that dumb horse trader she married.
This would make a story if there was anybody to tell it, Carl said. You want me to carry your body 3,000 miles because you used to go picnicking with a girl on the Guadalupe River.
That, plus I want to see if you can do it, Augustus said.
But you won't know if I do it. I reckon I'll do it, since you've asked. He said no more, and soon noticed that Augustus was dozing. He pulled his chair closer to the window. It was a cool night, but the lamp made the little room stuffy. He blew it out. There was a little moonlight. He tried to doze, but couldn't for a time. Then he did doze and woke to find Augustus wide awake, burning with fever. Carl lit the lamp, but could do nothing for him. That was the Muscle Shell River, where you were holed up, he said. I met that old trapper, and he told me. We may take him with us to scout, since he knows the country.
I wish I had some better whiskey, Augustus said. This is a cheap product.
Well, the saloon's closed, probably, Carl said.
I doubt they got better. Open or closed. I have a few more instructions if you're ready to hear them.
Why, fine, Carl said. I suppose now you've decided you'd rather be buried at the South Pole.
Nope. But do stop Nebraska a night and let the women know.